Well, good morning. It's Friday, July 17th. We have the local news hour coming up in just a few minutes here. And for this morning, the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources Information Officer Faith Heaton Jolly will be on to talk about the quagga mussel infestation and new wildlife safety website that they have partnered with to help people understand what best practices there are for us when we encounter wildlife. Then up is Max Doelny, Park City Council member, with a recap of the Park City Council meeting last night. And finally, we bid farewell to our own David Boyle, who has been part of KPCW's news team for the past 2+ years. And we will talk with him about some very exciting journalism awards that he won just recently and just where he is headed. So stay tuned for KPCW's Local News Hour. Thanks for listening this morning. Well, Wasatch County Council approved their primary canvass and ordinances related to Grandma and wells in the county, and KPCW's David Boyle has more on this. Well, the Summit County Council Wednesday talked about how to deal with Snyderville Basin trailheads that are congested, impacting their surrounding neighborhoods and, in at least one case, creating a fire safety hazard. The council looked at one especially popular trailhead in the Sun Peak neighborhood. County officials are considering a parking enforcement regimen to start dealing with the area in the short term. Rick Bruff reports.
Council member Roger Armstrong said there's a gigantic number of issues, as he put it, with Rob's trail along Bear Hollow Drive. The council wants to focus on Rob's as a template for dealing with other trailheads in Snyderville. Representing the Snyderville Recreation District, staffers Matt Wagoner, Ben Castro, and Melissa O'Brien said there are 18 parking spaces at the Robbs Trailhead, and when they're full, parking spills out along the sides of the road. They showed a plan for adding 6 more spaces a short distance away, with other stretches of the road marked as no parking. Wagoner said that as soon as this Saturday the 18th, they could put out signage and social media postings giving notice that restrictions are coming. By August, a new county ordinance would give authority to the rec district to ticket vehicles or tow them if necessary. County Attorney Margaret Olson said she can bring a draft ordinance to the next regular meeting of the council, which is set for July 29th. By September, any vehicles parked outside designated areas would be towed. Council members generally agreed with that approach. Council member Roger Armstrong said neighbors in the Robbs area are putting up with trespassers, packages of dog waste left in their yards, and tailgate parties. Trails advocates such as Charlie Sturgis of the Mountain Trails Foundation have hoped that an education approach would solve the problems, but Armstrong said that so far this season, that has not worked.
By the way, we're a month later. We had this conversation in June. We've been having these conversations for over a year. I've heard from, you know, Charlie and others, be kind, be gentle. Let's educate. Let's get the bike shops to, you know, inform people. There's nothing, you know, us making a decision today does not stop any of that from happening. And if it is happening, then it's not working because people are having barbecues and parties at the trailheads across the street from neighborhoods. They're still directly impacting properties by trespassing up there. There are still conflicts happening up there. So it's been a month. It hasn't gotten better. If anything, it's gotten worse. So the kinder, gentler we can take care of this with education and ambassadors is not working. So the nice words about it aren't going to fly anymore. Either the behaviors have to come under control fairly quickly, or we're going to have to go to the next step. And the next step is going to be closing that trailhead.
Council Chairman Doug Clyde agreed that the kinder, gentler approach has, as he put it, failed miserably. Armstrong suggested that for a subsequent stage, the county can issue free parking permits for local residents. Deputy County Attorney Dave Thomas said that can be done legally and would not be considered discrimination.
It will not be an equal protection issue because we have a rational basis. And the rational basis is, you know, you're a resident. If you're a resident, you have certain rights over non-residents who have not paid. Just like we have those kind of same things for for example, individuals using our landfill and so forth. So we can make those kinds of reasonable restrictions.
Councilmember Kim Carson said the issue is incredibly difficult. Doug Clyde said the resolution won't be easy and it's not going to come soon.
We know just from the experience of others, as well as our own personal experience, that everything that we do here is going to be difficult and expensive and is going to irritate people, be that a person who's driving up from Salt Lake or a person in the county who's used to driving over there and parking at will. This is not going to be pleasant or easy. It's going to take a long time. You know, we'll be at this for years before we get it solved. But we want to take the immediate step of beginning.
During the discussion, council members discussed another crowded trailhead. This one they said could be dangerous. They said a resident had supplied photos, reportedly from a drone, of Matterhorn and Innsbruckstrasse in Summit Park, which are intended to be fire exit routes. The photos show around 45 cars parked along both sides of the road. Councilmember Glenn Wright said the situation is frightening. For KPCW, I'm Rick Baroff.
We have Utah Division of Wildlife Resources Public Information Officer Faith Heaton Jolly on the line. She is going to talk to us about the infestation of quagga mussels and a new website that they have partnered with called Wild Aware Utah. Good morning, Faith. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so it looks like the DWR and Utah State Parks inspected more than 16,000 boats in an effort to prevent the quagga mussels spreading into Utah's waterways, and this all over the 4th of July weekend. But there's the information appears that it is lower than last year, of course, due to COVID impacts. But there are concerns, apparently, that DWR has about how many contaminated boats were found this year. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so, you know, it was a pretty busy weekend. And even though it was slightly, our numbers were slightly lower than last year, overall, actually, this year, our inspection and decontamination numbers have increased by 43%. So there's a lot of people getting out on the water right now. You know, and kind of like you mentioned, COVID-19 might have a impact on that just because a lot of other things are canceled. So people are kind of looking to the outdoors to get out and spend some time. So yeah, we've done a lot of decontaminations and inspections this year. And you know, it's something that's basically always ongoing because we're trying to prevent that spread of the invasive quagga mussels. Like you said, currently they're only found in Lake Powell. So we're really, really trying to keep them from spreading to other water bodies because once they kind of, you know, establish themselves in a water body, it's very, very difficult to get rid of them.
And is the only way to get rid of them basically when you're decontaminating a boat? I mean, once they're in the water body, are there measures that are taken that DWR uses?
So honestly, they're in a lot of other water bodies in Western states as well. And there's really honestly not a them because they are so resilient. You know, chemicals don't work very well. And so, yeah, kind of our biggest thing is to prevent them from getting to another water body in the first place. And, you know, the reason we do all these boat inspections and decontaminations is we know that watercraft are kind of a primary transport for these mussels. They'll just, you know, stay in some of the water that's in the boat. And so that's why we put such an emphasis on these inspections.
So what happens to a boater who does not participate in those checkpoints where, you know, before going into the water? I mean, are there citations issued? What does that mean to someone who's not, you know, complying?
Yeah, so it is law that you need to stop at any open inspection station or at any open administrative checkpoint, which those are kind of like UHP's DUI checkpoints that they do on highways. All vehicles actually have to stop at those, and then those without watercraft, you know, obviously can continue on. So, yeah, it is a Class B misdemeanor if somebody isn't stopping at these at these inspection stations. And that's typically what, you know, when somebody is cited, that's typically what it's for, is they just haven't, they, you know, they're failing to stop these inspection stations. Some they have, you know, sometimes the citations are infractions of some of the different laws as well. Like this year, it was, the law was passed that you have to remove your boat plug when you're transporting a watercraft on a roadway. And so, you know, that's something that we're just really trying to spread that message. And honestly, it is for everyone. You know, this isn't us just trying to come down on boaters. You know, we're, if, like I said, if these invasive quagga mussels get into a water body, it can really mess up the water infrastructure overall. It can cause a lot of damage to that water body's, you know, ecosystem. So there's just a lot of really long-lasting effects from this.
Yeah, so it's more of a social impact and environmental impact to everyone. Sounds interesting in this time of COVID when we're all debating mask wearing, isn't it? So what about citations? Did you issue more citations than usual over this past weekend?
I don't believe that there were necessarily more. Well, there were more this 4th of July weekend compared to the previous year. So this 4th of July weekend, we issued approximately 55 across the state. So that included, you know, boats leaving Lake Powell. That's kind of our primary focus, but then also boats at other water body state parks, things like that. And then compared to 2019 4th of July weekend, we issued 45. You know, so that is something that's a little concerning to see that number go up, because it means that less people are either aware, you know, that they have to stop, or there's just less people that are choosing to comply. So that's something we really encourage boaters, you know, just, it does take, you know, sometimes it'll take a little bit longer maybe to leave the lake, to, you know, wait and get one of these inspections, but it's so, so important. And so we just really encourage boater compliance with this.
Sure. Just the right thing to do. Hey, quickly, we just have a minute, but can you talk to us a little bit about this new website, and the wildlife education program that you've been working on and that you've now made available to anybody who's interested in learning more about it?
Yeah, totally. This is such a great resource for Utahns. It's called Wild Aware Utah. It actually was launched in 2010. Basically, like you said, it's a way to give Utah residents and visitors, you know, wildlife awareness and safety information. And this program, it's a collaboration between us, the Division of Wildlife Resources, Utah Togol Zoo, and the Utah State University Extension. And we're just really trying to, you know, kind of promote how you should interact with wildlife, the do's and don'ts, and then just general safety tips for all different species throughout Utah.
Okay. And can you give us a location on that? WildlifeUtah.org?
Yes. So it's wildawareutah.org. Yep. And we've had a website for a while, but we just really redesigned it and launched this new website earlier this week. And it has some great resources. So we definitely encourage people to check that out. It'll give you tips and information on things as, you know, as far as like what to do if you find a baby bird that's out of a nest, and what should you do if you see a moose on a trail. So it's just a wide range of information, and it's a really good resource for people that they can use.
And there are some really great photos on there, too. So
there are, yep. Yeah. And it has general wildlife information and photos, too. That's kind of fun to learn and see.
Good to accompany our kids back to school. These are great things to share with your children, right?
Exactly. While you're stuck at home and you're trying to find something for the kids to do, let them loose on this website and let them, you know, have some fun learning about Utah's wildlife, for sure.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. This is Faith Heaton Jolly with the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. I appreciate you coming on this morning.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Talk soon. Bye. Yes, good morning. It's 8:30, and next on the line we have Max Doyle, the Park City Council member, here to talk about last night's City Council meeting. Thank you, Max, for holding and for staying on the line here.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Well, so last night you all covered the active transportation issue, which also addressed the 2007 walkability bond funds that had been generated from a $15 million bond that passed in 2007, and The pot of money has grown somewhat in the past 12 years, and it's now at about $4 million, starting off somewhere around, or $5 million rather, starting off somewhere around $4 million. We do know much has changed in this past 12 years, and certain problems, however, still exist in the areas, specifically Snow Creek Shopping Center to the Jans and Colesport four-way intersection. And now, of course, we're adding to that the Arts and Culture District, and more traffic, more people, more folks out trying to use the surface roads in other ways besides being in cars. Can you talk a little bit about what your conversation was and what has come out of that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the walkability bond that we did in 2007 has really yielded quite a bit of fruit. We have the Bonanza Tunnel, the Comstock Tunnel, the Kearns Tunnel. We improved crosswalks with new colors, speed bumps in different zones. We have the 248 bike lanes, Summit bike share program. We have the different bike lanes all over town, including, you know, the painted what share rows, which are where you see the bike with the arrows in the road where you're in a lane. We have more of that to come. But boy, what I'm seeing and what we talked about last night is, it's just amazing to see how many people are using all of these resources that we've put in over the years. And quite frankly, all it does is highlight how important it is to be able to get around on a bike or a one wheel or on foot or on a skateboard scooter. And we're, you know, during COVID, we've seen so many families out around together that we find this to be a really critical, high priority for us going forward. We're lucky that we have some money left to work with, not quite enough to do some of our big over or under projects that we would really love to do, but we're discussing how to achieve some of those goals long term, and we have a lot of plans in the works for more walkability, and that's what the conversation sort of revolved around last night.
And what are your thoughts? What do you want to see happen with that Snow Creek Shopping Center area and how it connects to, into the heart of Park City?
Yeah, you know, that is actually something we talked about a little bit last night. The overpass over there is it's just an extremely expensive project. We have to work with UDOT. Obviously, we had the conversation earlier this year about widening that road and what they were going to do with that, which put pause on a project to go over or under that road. So unfortunately, that on last night's discussion, it kind of got pushed off to the side a little bit in lieu of all of these little projects that continue to make, you know, everyday users happy. But it was a topic of conversation. We are looking at ways to sort of transition some more funds into the, or some more money into this fund so that we could hopefully address that issue as soon as possible. And I personally raised it as a primary level of concern, because that's a side of town that we need to be able to get across that street, 248, and a little safer. So, yeah.
Is there a timeline associated with addressing that? Because it has been 12 years.
That's true. Well, in that 12 years, we did provide two tunnels to get across that road, just not up on that side by the cemetery and Snow Creek. And again, we have to work with UDOT. So the timeline is still ambiguous, unfortunately, but it's a high priority and we want to talk more about it.
Okay, excellent. Let's talk about mailboxes. That was on the discussion on the agenda. They're called gang mailboxes, which is an interesting name. there's a lot of history on this issue. It's been discussed since 2011, I believe, maybe even before that. And there are problems around right-of-ways, narrow roads, the way they look, the aesthetics of it. What did council decide should happen with the whole mail delivery situation in Old Town?
Yeah, so our direction to staff last night ended up being that we want to get a little bit more data on how many households do we need to serve in Old Town. And, you know, so we don't really know the exact number. We do know from the Postal Service that you have to have a mailbox for every address in Old Town. Knowing exactly what number that is really critical, because it's not the exact same number as those who are at the post office now. There are people who don't live in Old Town who use that post office. So we can't just say we need to build this number of cluster mailboxes or gang boxes, as you said. So we need to know how many of them we need to build, and then we need to look really quickly at where could we put those in a way that wouldn't impede right away, would be safe, snow removal would be easy to do, et cetera, et cetera. So there are a couple of questions, but then as soon as those questions, which should be relatively quick to answer, are answered, then we would like to do a survey of all the people who would be affected in Old Town and see what they want us to do, because we've been basically making assumptions for a long time about what they want. And I think it's really important that we know exactly what the residents want. But there are some problems with P.O. boxes being your only point of getting your mail. For instance, people who don't know that you have a P.O. box, they just know your address. They send you a package and it never gets to your house because they won't deliver it to a P.O. box and they can't deliver it to your house. That's a legitimate problem. We're trying to figure out how do we address that type of concern in the most efficient way possible.
I see. And so obviously there are only a certain number that are really affected by the difficulty of mail delivery, like the very southern part of Old Town, correct, because of steep and narrow streets. But can't delivery happen in some of the other more flat sections of Old Town?
So we actually had a little discussion about that, and there might be a little nuance in there that's getting lost. In that flat section of Old Town, I believe what the postmaster would want is they don't want to get out of their car to deliver, so it wouldn't be like somebody walking down the sidewalk and going up to your door and dropping it on the door. It would be more like they want mailboxes, and in that right of way, there's really no way to put it. It would have to come so far out onto the street. We have big-time parking and snow removal issues in that part of town, so we're not sure that that's actually a viable solution on that north part of Old Town. They've been over that a couple of different times, but we really want to come up with a solution for the entirety of the population. As you saw in the staff report, it's all in orange. There's another section that's crossed out as a potential deliverable zone. But we want to come up with a solution for everybody, and we're trying to go through and figure out what those solutions look like.
Okay. So next step is just basically to get a count on how many households we're talking about.
Yeah, get a count, find some zones where we could put some mailboxes. How big would they be? How would the snow removal work, et cetera?
Sure. Okay. Let's move on and talk about the small business support program that Park City had approved $250,000 to fund during the budget discussions this spring. Can you talk about what was decided, if anything, on how those funds will be distributed?
Well, the predominant conversation there was that, you know, it's with $250,000, we've seen some different loan funds around town trying to offer up, you know, $5,000 to $25,000 loans, different grant programs. Not all of them are tapped out. Summit County has some programs going. So last night's conversation for council was sort of revolved around if you were going to give a $5,000 grant to somebody, what does that buy them? Does that get them a month? Does that help them pay payroll for a couple of weeks? And when is the best time to do that? This pandemic isn't anywhere near its end. And the lion's share of our economic revenue comes in the wintertime. So council thought it best to hold that money back for a little while and figure out the best way to get it into the hands who need it most at the time when it will do the most good. Another option was to try and use that $250,000 to maybe get more money out of it by having matching grants, et cetera, So sort of shopping the market for who would match that money so that we could turn that $250 into more money and we could do more good with it.
Okay, so just postponing just a little bit. Do you have any idea how much federal assistance our small businesses have been able to access?
Boy, I don't have, you know, specific numbers. There was something that was brought up last night that during the when the PPP program came out, the average amount of money that people were getting in our region was somewhere, you know, was north of $100,000. So we're talking about big, big money, and our $250,000 that we have as a grant program just can't do what might be needed to save a company in the middle of this economic downturn. So we're trying to kind of hold tight for a little while and see how we can do the best with that money. But there's been a lot of money dispersed, and I know some companies have done a lot of good with it, which is heartening. And we heard some really good news. Steve and I walked Main Street the other day, and we were talking to business owners over there, and we were surprised by how positive they were. We know that doesn't represent everybody, but it's nice to hear some good news in the midst of all this.
Yeah, and is that in? Were you walking it during the car-free Sunday?
No, we are up there during those days, but council's doing walk-in talks on Main Street. We sort of divided up the street. We're trying to get out there and just walk in and talk to business owners and employees and see how things are going. 'Cause you can only get so much from a report. And they're pretty appreciative that we're coming in. We're checking in with them. We're asking what we can do better, what's worked, what hasn't worked, et cetera.
Okay. One thing I wanted to ask about, you've sort of mentioned this in a number of forums about how important it is to put in place the right practices now in order to save December, January, February. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and what you mean by that?
Sure. I come from the small business world, right? I own a couple businesses in town, and I'm used to the seasonal ebbs and flows of business. I have to, you know, significantly reduce my operation twice a year. So I'm used to having to plan out for the future, right? And I know that Park City generates most of its revenue in December, January, February, and March. And if you're not ready to kind of hold the line for a little while, it can be really hard. I've made the mistake of not preparing in the past, and it hurt, and it was a scramble to get there. This sort of puts everybody in that category, and I feel like it's really important that Park City figure out how to be ready to capitalize as much as possible in as short a time as possible, and that's this winter. When people have proven that when we're open, they'll come here and spend money. But they won't come here if we're not safe, if we're not a safe place to be, if we're one of the hot spots in the country, it's harder to come here. If we're not a safe place to travel out of, they won't come here. Currently, you have to wait 2 weeks to go back to New York if you're in Utah. So, and that's a huge market for us. We need to be the safest place or as safe a place as possible so that people can come here and ski and spend their money so that we can make it through the next year. And no September in my life has ever provided enough income for any business to make it through the year, but there are many Decembers, Januaries, and Februaries that have done that. So I feel firmly that Park City needs to buckle up and sacrifice so that we can have a solid winter.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else you want to say about the meeting last night?
No, Carolyn, not much. I just want to say I'm really excited for all the walkability stuff in Park City. We've been using it a lot. I love seeing families out together. I've seen family units more in the last 4 months than I have maybe ever. And Becca said it best. She said, God, I want to do all of these projects right now, but we obviously have to pick and choose the ones that are going to do the most. But that one's really cool, and I'm looking forward to seeing what Park City looks like in the next 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. Appreciate you coming on this morning.
Thanks a lot, Carolyn. Have a good day.
You too. On the line, we have our own departing David Boyle, KPCW reporter since April of 2018, and he is leaving us to explore other endeavors. And but in the meantime, he also had received some significant recognition, journalism recognition, and we wanted to just wish you the best and maybe talk about what you're heading off to do and give you some accolades on these awards that you received. Thanks for joining us, David.
Well, thanks so much for having me this morning, Carolyn. It's a very bittersweet day. Well, today especially is very bitter to be leaving KPCW. Yeah, I'm excited to join and talk about the past 2 years and what's coming up next.
Yeah, so before we, you know, embarrass you by talking about your recent awards and accomplishments, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background, where you come from, what your education was, and how you found your way to KPCW and where you're headed?
Sure. Yeah, so I grew up in Monticello, Utah, which is a town about 50 miles south of Moab in San Juan County. My dad owns the San Juan Record there, which is a weekly newspaper. So I grew up, you know, putting ads into inserts and, you know, going to businesses and dropping off papers and picking them up. And that evolved to me working some summers, you know, at my senior year of high school and then throughout college. I worked for the newspaper. I studied at Brigham Young University and got a degree in communications with an emphasis on news media. And while there, I also got to do some internships with KUER across the other side of the mountains. After graduation, I worked a few jobs and then ended up applying and spending these 2 years at KPCW, and it's been great.
Well, it's been more than great for us. We have completely enjoyed having you as part of our news team. And as you're heading down south, talk a little bit about what exactly you're going to be doing.
Yeah, so I'm headed back home. So my wife and I had our first baby in June, and so we decided it would be good to be closer to family. And also there's a new opportunity there. My dad, who still owns the newspaper, also recently bought a commercial radio station. So my title there will be as news director, so I'll help gather county news for the paper and then more regional news for the radio station. So that includes Moab and Cortez. And then, of course, you know, such a small operation, I'll be wearing a lot of hats, too, and maybe have to sell some ads, too, which, maybe violate some journalistic integrity, but we'll keep the business running. So, you know, it's a bit of weighing competing interests there. But it should be a good opportunity to be working with my dad and having a little bit more responsibility.
Well, and yes, in that area, boy, a big area, very mixed demographic. It includes, of course, the tourist area of Moab. Bluff is becoming more of an attraction. Even Monticello, just with Bears Ears and all of that, and then you have the rural communities that live there and go to school and work, and then of course the Navajo Reservation. So, probably a pretty interesting and diverse area. What are your thoughts on that? And do you have an idea about how you're going to approach it?
Yeah. There's definitely it's nice that there's a little bit of diversity. Yeah, it's definitely a mixed community, and there's different issues going on. You know, there's growth in the Spanish Valley, which is right next to Moab, and Monticello and Blanding have their challenges, and then, you know, down on the reservation, there's even some basic needs that, you know, have issues being met, including, you know, a lot of homes don't have electricity. So, it's definitely going to be diverse in our coverage, and we're looking forward to expanding our coverage too on the Navajo Reservation. That's a place that's been underserved by news, and so we're excited to increase that as well.
Yeah, sure. And then, of course, all of the impacts of COVID-19 and how devastating it has been down there, but more on the reservation than really in the other, white communities, I guess. And that's a really interesting opportunity to elevate.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely will be. There's, it's been hit really hard on the Navajo Reservation. They actually close for the weekends. They close down everything, and people aren't supposed to go out to work or shop or anything. It's crept up into the northern part of San Juan County, and Blanding's population is fairly mixed between Native Americans and whites, and so there's been more in Blanding and more in Monticello as of late. But yeah, it's an area that COVID-19 is still a huge issue, as it is throughout the U.S. obviously.
Yeah. Well, you're also leaving us just as you had been awarded, well, 6 awards in total from the Utah Society of Professional Journalists. The first place, Best Radio Reporter, and that was for a story you did. It was titled A Year in the Wasatch Back, and all these stories can also be found online if interested in having a listen. And then you also received a first place general news on the issue of pride banners on Heber City's Main Street and the public comment that generated. And now, of course, I believe it's next week, they're having a city council meeting that is evaluating their policy on banners and just what they're going to do going forward.
Yeah, that was a really interesting story. Heber actually beat Park City to the punch, I believe, to put pride banners up. And, it was an emotional meeting to be at. Some people sharing their personal experiences and some people sharing, their disagreement with the city putting banners up. And then, there was even points brought up that, hey, if we have to be careful about politicizing this, politicizing Main Street. And so that's actually what they're going to be talking about in this coming meeting is, how they make sure that that the banners are used properly on Main Street. And so, yeah, they're considering an ordinance to make it so that it's got to be connected to a city or county sponsored event to be on Main Street. It was a very interesting story, and the Society of Professional Journalists agreed, I guess.
Yeah. And then you also received, David, another first place award for best use of sound. And this is the mucking competitor winning the 15-year-in-a-row title at the Park City Miners Day, which is, a big event in Park City for locals especially.
That was a lot of fun. There was, the loud machines that were using the natural sound. And then I interviewed this winner, this man, I want to say maybe in his 60s or 70s, this Hispanic man who's, spent his life mining and just kills the competition every year and has a great sense of humor. And it was a really fun story.
Yeah. And maybe folks ought to go back and listen to that, because there are probably, although it hasn't been announced, but it's pretty unlikely we're going to be doing a Miners Day celebration here this year due to the COVID-19 efforts to, stop the spread of that illness. But, and then finally, your other fourth award that is a first place award is for multimedia journalism. And this was a really interesting and very touching story about special needs track meet.
Yeah, so Wasatch County School District, along with South Summit and Park City School District, held this tri-district track meet. It was really cool to go and see, these students. They got to compete in this, track and field or field day type event, and lots of just encouragement from students and teachers, and really a day for all those students to shine. And so, the multimedia part, I was able to get quite a few students on film, you know, competing, having fun, laughing, and so that's on the website. You know, we have that video along with the sound, and then it played on the radio as well. That was the multimedia aspect of that award.
Yeah, well, congratulations on all those. It is so nice to have you have KPCW at the top on these awards. There were a number of entries that came from KUER, KCPW, Utah Public Radio, and KSL News Radio. And yeah, it's really great to have KPCW highlighted in that way. So congratulations on that.
Thanks, Carolyn. And KPCW's name should be at the top of that. I came to this job, you know, with a lot of journalism experience, but honestly, very little, no radio experience. I remember one of my first broadcasts, I pronounced Wanship as Wanship. And anyways, so I learned a lot in these past 2 years, and it couldn't be possible without people like you and Leslie and Renee and the whole staff and the board and everyone. And so KPCW is a great community resource that has served me personally well, and I have seen it serve the community as well.
Well, thanks, David. We wish you and your beautiful family all the best, and I hope you'll stay in touch with us.
Absolutely.
All right. Take care now.
Okay. Thank you, Carolyn. We'll see you.
You've been listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. It is 9 o'clock. Before we take you back to NPR, just a reminder that stay tuned to KPCW through the day. We'll continue to provide updates on this big hollow fire, which started last night or yesterday afternoon, but did involve having to evacuate some homes. Looks like maybe 50 to 100 homes have been affected, and they're on voluntary evacuation orders now. And like I said, we'll keep you posted. Stay safe and be aware of high winds today. Thanks for listening.